Welcome to the Nordic Model Now podcast, providing critical narratives on the global sex trade.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this webinar. First, a few housekeeping things. So you can type questions into the Q&A box at any time, but please understand that we most probably won't have time to answer them all. Any that aren't answered, we'll use to inform our future events. So the hashtag for the event is NMNTalk. If you're going to be tweeting about the event, then please use this hashtag. So here it is. Thank you. So first of all, what is the Nordic model? So very briefly, the Nordic model has three main elements. First, the decriminalization of prostituted women, which means any woman involved in prostitution will not receive a criminal conviction. Second, it's the buying sex that becomes a criminal offence. So pimps, johns, sex buyers and brothel owners would be criminalised. And third, provide effective services for those involved in prostitution, including exiting routes. So there's plenty of information about the model on our website if you want more information about that. So our first speaker is Lily, and we're thrilled that she's with us today. Lily is a survivor of trafficking, perpetrated both by family members and as part of domestic violence and abuse. She's also a survivor of the violence that's intrinsic to these experiences. Lily works with a number of organisations speaking about the lived experience and impact of abuse, trafficking, prostitution and domestic violence. Lily is also a person-centred therapist working with victims and survivors of sexual violence. So welcome, Lily.
Thank you, Ali. So I'm just going to share my screen and pull up a presentation. I made the decision to not have my camera on in terms of privacy and safety. So I'm going to talk a little bit, in theory, there we go, right. I'm going to talk a little bit about my experiences of being trafficked and how that links to victim blaming. So a little bit about my history. So within a couple of days of being brought home from the hospital, the abuse that I was experiencing started. My main perpetrator was actually my mum. From the age of about four, she started to traffic me kind of from within the home. And later on, she got into a new relationship. He also was abusing me. And as a result, the trafficking that I'd already been experienced became a lot more organised. That kind of continued at various different levels up until I was about 14. At that point, I chose to make myself homeless. Probably not the right term there, but I became homeless at that age. I ran away and I began to prostitute myself at that point. I was living in a squat and I was deliberately going out into the city, going to nightclubs, going to pubs, and basically finding random men who weren't going to ask too many questions about age, who didn't care that much about age. And I would prostitute myself in those situations. And I often left with their money as well, knowing that they weren't going to report it because I was 14 and they would have to confess some more. I later became homeless again at the age of 16. I was homeless for quite a few years and I've lived in various different homeless accommodations. So I started off in a refuge and then moved around to different kind of young people supported accommodations. I also ended up in a number of abusive relationships at this point. Both of them were with men. I knew that I was a lesbian at this point, but my level of self-worth and my ability kind of protect myself and keep myself out of those situations wasn't really feasible at that point. I didn't have that ability, the knowledge, or the amount of self-worth to care about myself enough to kind of keep out of those situations. So that first abusive relationship was somebody that I'd met online who had been grooming me since the age of about 13. It did involve him selling me as well, him trafficking me mostly for drugs. mostly for weed. That relationship didn't last very long, but once I was able to get out of that, I then very quickly fell into another relationship with somebody that had been stalking me since I started college. I couldn't get rid of him for several months, and I eventually made the decision, I'll go on a pity date with him. He wasn't getting the message. Maybe I could let him down gently by saying, sorry, it didn't work out. It didn't work like that. I wasn't able to get out of that relationship, and I was stuck there for 5 years. He had managed to find out a lot about my history and my history of being trafficked and my history of being used in pornography as well. He managed to get access to some of that, and he quite often used those things that I'd shared with him and that he'd seen against me as a kind of reenacting of those things. And he also began to sell me as well, mostly to his friends. At one point specifically sold me in exchange for a pizza because he was hungry. I was able to, so whilst this was happening, whilst I was in those relationships, I was still going back and forth to my family. That later relationship, the one that lasted for 5 years, it included a lot of financial abuse as well. The moment that money went into my account, I was working 4 jobs, I was going to uni, I had my student finance going in there. But the moment any money went in there, he would take that money, and I would very quickly kind of lose access to that. And it left me in a situation where I risked being homeless again. And that was an experience that had terrified me so much that I couldn't face going back there. And I reached a point where I had exhausted everybody in my life in terms of asking for money and taking out loans with people. I ran out of options, and it reached the point where the only option I had was going back to my mum and asking her for money. But that inevitably meant that I had to earn it, that I had to work for it, that I had to be sold and trafficked and raped in order to get any money to stop myself from becoming homeless again. So at the age of 22, with the help of a charity I was kind of volunteering with at that point, I was able to get out of those situations. I changed my name. I moved as far away as I could face moving, not probably as far away as I should have moved, but it was a balance between not being in the same area, but still having access to that charity, where I actually had safe people in my life and had people that cared about me, people that loved me, people that made me feel safe. And I started trying to put myself back together again, or maybe even not back together, because everything started so early. It was never a case of recovering me before the abuse. It was a case of discovering who I was outside of the abuse that I'd experienced. So I went through all of this effort to rebuild myself. It involved a hell of a lot of therapy and kind of really committing to that process of learning to love myself, I think is ultimately the best way that I can put it. Having compassion for myself, and I mean, in tone of what this workshop is, not blaming myself for the experiences that I had. And I've now reached a point where I'm okay. You know, I'm in a really secure, loving relationship. I'm still having therapy, but I'm also a therapist myself now. And I work specifically with people that have experienced sexual violence and offering them some of what I was offered, some of that care, some of that compassion, some of that just kind of real, genuine human connection that I really needed at that point in my life. That if I hadn't had someone show me that I was worth something, that I was a real person, that I wasn't just, my mum always called me a whore right from a very young age. That was what I was, that was what I was destined to be. And it was something I really believed, but later on, I was able to reach a point where enough people told me different that I started to believe it myself. And that got me to the place that I'm in now, which is this kind of weird place between professional and personal, where I have both of those sets of knowledge. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about my experience of victim blaming. Now, you might have noticed that I very specifically use the word trafficking for my experiences. And that's twofold. The first reason is because trafficking actually really fits the experiences that I have. If you look at the definition of trafficking, that fits what my experience is. But I also very deliberately avoid the use of word prostitution. And my reason for that is because of that stigma and because of that victim blaming that we have in this society. That when we think of prostitution, we're supposed to think and often do think that it's something that's a choice, that it's an empowering thing that's chosen because we just love having sex so much. If you haven't noticed, I'm saying this in a really facetious way. That's not what I believe. Whereas using the word trafficking, I get to specify that something was done to me. I get to identify as a victim, somebody that was a victim of a crime that I had no control over. Not something that I chose, not something that I went into willingly, not something that is, yeah, more empowering. I get to be a victim. And whilst I say all of that, it's worth noting that I can never entirely escape that victim blaming. But even though I get to use this nice fancy label that means that it was something that happened to me, not something I chose, I still get that victim blaming. And that victim blaming comes both from society, but it comes from services as well. So whilst my experience with various services, including, if not especially, therapy, particularly therapy in the NHS, within the NHS, it's not been ideal. But there was a difference, and I could feel that difference, that when I used the word trafficking, I was treated as a victim. I was treated with empathy and kindness, and I wasn't overtly blamed for the experiences that I had. And I found it gave me a lot more access to services. So that women's refuge that I mentioned before that I was in when I was 16, 17, they really specifically had a policy that they didn't let in women that had been prostituted. That wasn't considered a form of violence against women and girls. It wasn't considered as a legitimate reason to need access to those services. But me having been trafficked gave me that access, and it gave me more access to services in general. Now, because I don't use the word prostitution, the flip side of that, I don't have as much personal experience of, but I know others who do have that experience. So who have been turned away from services like that women's refuge, who are often deemed to be too complex. And you can't see me because I've got my camera off, but I definitely did the quotation marks around complex there. And that impact of a criminalized history is definitely a factor there as well. But overwhelmingly, it's that those experiences aren't seen as sexual violence. They're seen as a choice and a willingness, and that maybe there was a rape that happened within that, but the whole history in and of itself is not treated as sexual violence. Whereas with trafficking, I get to call all of it sexual violence, not just a one-off bad experience within that. So most of the victim blaming I do experience, I find tends to come in the form of why questions. And they're usually linked to the longevity of the trauma that I experienced. So a lot of it comes down to, why didn't I tell anybody? Why didn't I just leave? Why did I let it happen? Why did I keep going back? And my absolute favorite one, and the one that haunts me to this day, is that idea of all of this can't happen to one person. So I'm going to talk a little bit, and I'm aware of the time, so I'm going to do it possibly a bit quicker than I was aiming to, about why it was I did stay, why it was I didn't say anything, why I was stuck in that situation. And hopefully with doing so, I can highlight a little bit about how that victim blaming worked. So my first issue was that we're talking about my mum here. And whether you want to use the phrase trauma bonding or whatever, I don't really care. But the simple reality is that she was my mum. And no matter what she did to me, I still loved her because she was my mum. I don't know how else to say that. She was my mum. It was as simple as that, really. But there was also this other extra factor. And it's the fact that women don't do this. Women don't traffic their children. Women don't carry out sexual violence in any way whatsoever. And as a feminist, and I am a radical feminist, I absolutely agree with that. I know that we live in a society where we're talking about male violence against women and girls. But I also know from my own experience that there isn't always a man behind that, that actually women are capable of that level of cruelty and maliciousness. And I know that's not a popular opinion with the radical feminist community, but that's what my experience tells me, is that there isn't always a man standing there. But what those ideas also offer, that idea that only men do this, is that impossibility for women with my experience to talk about that. Because mums don't do that, and that means we can't talk about it. So my other fear, the other reason why I couldn't say these things, was a fear of repercussions if I did. Now, at one point, I did make a report specifically against my mum's boyfriend that included aspects of the trafficking that I experienced. And that case fell through. It was no further actioned. And I was raped again in revenge for having made that report in the first place. I also very much feared for my life. I'd seen the way the other girls and women I'd been trafficked with had been punished for trying to leave or for going against their rules. And the other fear, and it's a fear that still sits with me now, is the child pornography that was filmed of me while I was a child is still out there. And if I go too far against their rules, will that also be used against me? And one of the other reasons that I wasn't able to say anything and I wasn't able to just leave was about the sense of self-worth that I had. And by sense of self-worth, I mean there was absolutely sod all of it. As I said before, I'd grown up with this constant ongoing message that I was only worth one thing, that I was a whore, that I was never going to be anything but that. And that was what I was fated to be. And being in that situation where I really believed those words and believed that was all I was worth, it never even occurred to me that this was something I should complain about, that this was something I should do something about, that this was something I should tell somebody about. Because I just didn't have enough care and valuing of myself to be able to do that. The other aspect was it kind of almost didn't feel real, even to me. In some ways, it felt very, very real to me, but in other ways, it just didn't. It felt like it was something that was out of a film, something that doesn't really happen. And if you remember, all of that can't happen to one person anyway. And it's, again, just another little way that that victim blaming comes in. That either there's something incredibly wrong with me that I let all of that happen, or I'm making it up and it didn't happen in the first place because that kind of thing doesn't really happen. And it all sounds like a really bad, I don't know, copycatting of the Taken film. The other aspect was I ran out of options. So I was in that abusive relationship. It involved financial abuse. And I was in a situation where I had a choice between homelessness and being trafficked further by my mum. And looking back on it, I would take the homelessness now. But being 20-odd year old, that was too much to kind of really consider. I couldn't face being in that position again. I needed even the tenuous security that I had in the flat that I was in at that point. And you have to remember that self-worth thing was there as well. I didn't deserve anything better. It was completely normalized to me at that point that that was all that I was worth. So having run out of all of those options, it left me stuck in a lot of ways. And it was only really when my ex-partner, he didn't exactly propose, he just announced us as being engaged, because that was the type of relationship that was. And it was also reaching the point where he could put his name on my tenancy agreement, and I knew I didn't have the strength to fight that. And I knew that if both of those things happened, I was going to be trapped in a way that was going to be much, much harder to get out of, and that was ultimately what made me leave. But for a lot of that relationship and a lot of my life, basically, I didn't really feel like I had the options that I couldn't risk facing the consequences of reporting or saying anything or doing anything in the first place. One of the other aspects was that gaslighting kind of aspect, particularly with that ex-partner that was around for 5 years. He really convinced me, and it was easy to convince me because, again, low self-worth, this has been my entire life so far. But it was really easy to convince me that I was complicit in what was happening, that actually I was this kinky little slut who just loved having sex with all of his friends and getting paid for it, that it was my idea, that it was something that turned me on, that it was something that I wanted. And that included the more violent aspects of that as well, the BDSM kink aspects of that as well. And because he had this kind of theory that because of my history, I was the one that was into that and I corrupted him. And I'm the one that pulled us into those situations. And again, because I hadn't had the opportunity to process what had happened to me at that point, because this stuff kept happening to me, and because I'd repeatedly been told that I was fated for that, I actually kind of believed them at that point. I convinced myself that it must be true, that it must just be me that's doing all of this, because it keeps happening over and over, so it had to be something about me in some way. And ultimately, what I needed was time. I needed time to be able to process these experiences. I needed time to be able to understand what was happening to me, to recognize that it wasn't normal, that that's not how people are brought up, that's not how girls are brought up, or at least it shouldn't be how girls are brought up. And I couldn't do that, not while I was still in that situation, not when I didn't have a single moment to myself where I could breathe, where I could reflect, where I could process those experiences to make some kind of sense of them. So what I'm trying to say about all of this, because it feels a bit more like I'm telling you my story and trying to justify myself for why I stayed in that situation for 22 years. But there's almost this constant pressure to justify myself, to say why I was in those situations for 22 years. That's how victim blaming works. That I've had to put up with this crap for so long. I apologize for swearing there. I know you're recording. But I've had to put up with it for so long that it's kind of become part of my own narrative. Those victim blaming ideas have become things that I use against myself. Well, why did you stay for 22 years? It would have been really simple to just go tell a teacher, go tell a youth worker, go tell your therapist, go tell your doctor, go tell someone. But it wasn't as simple as that. And that's kind of how insidious victim blaming is, that it gets under your skin, your own narrative and your own self-blame as well. So what from here? What does all of this mean? So those victim blaming messages, they really impact our ability to process and to find a way to live with our experiences. When you're constantly being questioned and undermined, when you're being doubted and blamed for the things that have happened, how the hell are you supposed to find a space to understand what those experiences mean, why they happened, how they happened? And how are you supposed to be able to make anything different and make any changes in your life if you're being undermined in that way? The other thing that comes to mind when I think about this as well is that they really impact our ability to name and understand those experiences, to see them as being sexual violence, to see them as being a crime and something that is harmful and dangerous. It also puts us at risk of further stigma and abuse. And by that, I mean, when we stick to those ideas of prostitution being this empowering, wonderful thing, it's really easy to then be sexualized again when we talk about our experiences. And it puts us at further risk, which, again, is exactly why I don't use the word prostitution. What needs to happen is that both trafficking and prostitution, and keeping in mind that semantically they might have different meanings, but actually there's really fine line between the two. But they both need to be recognized as abuse and sexual violence. And we really need to question the stigma and the messages that we give about both of those experiences. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen at this point. I just want to thank everyone for listening to me go through that. And I'll pass you back over to Ali now.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Lily, there. I think most people would have found that quite difficult to hear. And for me, I can only thank you for the courage and bravery actually in working to try and change things for other women as well. One thing I picked up on, which I'd like to just reiterate as well, was when you were talking about the questions about why. And some people were saying to you, all this just can't happen to one person, one woman. And I think for me, that just highlights the myriad of violent and abusive experiences that we as women actually do face throughout our lifetime. So again, just a big thank you for sharing your story with us. Thank you. So our next speaker then is Dr. Jessica Taylor. So we're thrilled to have Jessica with us here tonight. Dr. Jessica Taylor is the founder of Victim Focus, an international research, teaching and consultancy organisation that has the aim of challenging the victim blaming and pathologisation of women and girls subjected to violence and abuse. She's the author of 5 books, and her latest book, Why Women Are Blamed for Everything, sold 10,000 copies in the first 6 weeks and was then bought by Hachette UK in a multi-book deal. So the first book is available in all good bookshops, on Kindle, hardback, paperback, and audiobook. So thank you, Jessica.
Thank you. Before I started, I just wanted to say thank you to Lily, and also to reiterate and just to support the argument that you and somebody else here has made that women can be perpetrators. I agree with you that I think there is potentially a discomfort around that in radical feminism. And I prefer to argue that I think it's misogynistic to argue that women can't be capable of these types of offences, and to consider us as essentially too weak to be perpetrators is a form of misogyny. So I just wanted to say that, because I agree with you, Lily, that it isn't really spoken about as much as it should be. So I'm going to talk to you briefly about some of the stuff around victim blaming that might be of interest to you, and some of the things that Lily's already brought up, actually. So if you've got any questions, you can put them in the question box, and then we're going to do a Q&A afterwards anyway. So I think the first thing that I wanted to pick up on really was that we have embedded victim blaming into the services and the narratives around all forms of exploitation, child sexual exploitation, human trafficking, prostitution, or what other people might call sex work in society. Victim blaming has been heavily embedded into that on purpose. So one of the things that I teach professionals about a lot is that there's been a very insidious movement around linguistics to increase victim blaming of especially teenage girls, I would say. So if we look first at children, you know, for a long period of time, we would describe teenage girls under the age of 18 as child prostitutes. And they would be described in legislation and law as willing sort of participants that sell themselves for things they want or need, money, somewhere to stay, drugs, alcohol, gifts, whatever. And that was pretty much the dominant way of talking about teenage girls who were being trafficked and exploited and bought and sold and tortured and abused and killed, was that they were child prostitutes, and they knew what they were doing. They were doing it on purpose because they wanted something. There was a lot of pressure from child rights organizations, feminist organizations, human rights organizations to argue against that. And in the UK and in parts of Europe and the US, the next thing that happened with this, and you have to really pay attention to what happened, was that we stopped calling it child prostitution, kind of, and called it abuse through prostitution. So that was the first change in the linguistics, was that it was like, some children are prostitutes, some of these girls are prostitutes, but they are being abused sometimes. And it was this sort of way of suggesting, as Lily said, that, oh, that, you know, they're in prostitution and sometimes they'll be abused, right? Again, that didn't last that long. There was still a lot of pressure from those organizations, especially in the UK. There was a couple of MPs that were pushing against it, including Anne Coffey, if anybody remembers or knows her. And so the Sorry, I'm just going to tell you right now that we have puppies and the dog, and they've just managed to like get in the room. So if a dog sort of flies across the screen, it's that's why. So the next thing that happened was this sort of move towards abuse through prostitution. And that was used in safeguarding legislation. It was used in law. This was probably like between 03 and like maybe sort of like 07, 08. So, you know, not that long ago. Within that, though, there was never really a positioning of these girls as victims of any crime, not necessarily. The next phrase or concept or terminology that was used was commercial exploitation. And this, again, was adopted in safeguarding legislation and in law in Europe, US, Canada, UK. And this, again, I mean, we're still talking about children here, but we started calling it commercial exploitation. And you can see the language gets further and further away from prostitution, but it doesn't really change anything other than the words. So the concept of commercial exploitation was this, they called it commercial environments rather than talking about what was actually happening to these teenage girls. And so they were talking really about, you know, massage parlors and brothels. They were talking about strip clubs. They were talking about street prostitution, and they were calling it commercial exploitation. You know, oh, these teenage girls are involved in commercial exploitation. It's all a very hygienic, palatable way of talking about the rape and abuse of teenage girls. And then around 2009, especially in the UK, we got to CSE, child sexual exploitation. So for those of you that work with children, you'll know that term already. And CSE, interestingly, is defined exactly the same way as child prostitution. The official definition of child sexual exploitation is a child who sells themselves for things they want or need. That's current. You can look that up. It's for the Department for Education and the UK government. Define child sexual exploitation as, you know, children selling themselves for things they want or need. It also goes further in the definition and says that the act may appear consensual, even if, you know, the child says it's not or something like that. And, you know, that to me terrifies me. I've like worked with girls and women for 12 years this year, and it really worries me that the definition essentially is victim blaming. If you consider that we've developed a national definition of child sexual exploitation of these teenage girls that actually positions them as selling themselves for things they want or need rather than being raped or abused or trafficked, we have a real problem here. So then the way that this sort of flows through into adult women is that these women and girls are always being positioned as being in control. And that's where a lot of the victim blaming comes from, that we are reframing the rape and the abuse and the trafficking and the murder of women and girls as not only a choice for them to, you know, make this neutral exchange for something they want, that they're informed, that it's consensual, but we now have the sexualization of that, this sort of modern, liberal, isn't it great, you know, these young girls can sell themselves and it's empowering and it's sexy and, you know, that sort of thing. So what you have there is this mixture between, you know, we've always positioned girls and women as almost like being in control in these situations when they're not, but you then have the mixture with objectification and sexualization. And what we know about objectification is this: it's the process of women and girls being reframed as an object to be used, to be abused, to be, you know, discarded once it's been used, right? And then if you team that with sexualization, which is the positioning of women and girls as a sexual object for somebody else's pleasure, what you get then is dementalization, which is this process of seeing women and girls as having no internal mental life, no intellect, you know, no emotion, no impact, that this stuff is not impacting them. They're just a sex object. They have no mental life. And so because of the process of dementalization, you then get the process of dehumanization. And so as Lily quite rightly said, when professionals are working with women and girls in prostitution, what they're seeing in their head is, and what they're seeing in these women and girls is like, oh, you know, They're chaotic, they're complex, they're choosing these things, they want to live like this. This is just what they want. They won't settle. You know, you can't talk to them. They're drinking, they're taking drugs, they're going out having sex with people. And all of this narrative, all of this victim blaming, it erases the offenders. These perpetrators who society tells them that they are entitled to buy access to women and girls' bodies, nobody even talks about them. Services don't mention them, campaigns don't mention them, police don't mention them. It's like a silence, like a total silence around them, because what happens is all of the interventions, all of the services end up focused on the woman or girl. And so one of the things that happens in terms of the victim blaming is you then get this intellectualization of prostitution and of trafficking and exploitation by middle-class white academics that, you know, sort of talk big about how sex work is empowering and they support their students to go into sex work, and that anybody who talks about it is, you know, against it is a bigot and is harmful and so on. But this is, for, you know, for me, that worries me. The classism around that really worries me, actually, and racism around that really worries me. But one of the things that you see in academic research, especially in criminology, psychology, sociology, and topics like that, is this obsession with academic research that looks for the reasons why women and girls are exploited and trafficked. And, you know, you have things like vulnerability theory, vulnerability research, resiliency research, ACEs, and stuff like that. And what it's doing is it's positioning the problems within the woman and the girl. So you have like decades of research looking for particular characteristics and behaviors and lifestyles and backgrounds of these women and girls, suggesting that you can almost predict their outcomes based on the things that are wrong with them, that the reason they're being exploited and trafficked is because of something that's inherently wrong with them. And that brings me, I guess, to the point that I wanted to raise and talk to you about, which is pathologization. The ultimate form of victim blaming of these women and girls is pathologization. And Lily picked up on that a little bit around this sort of narrative that these women are just too complex, you know? And so I see a lot of this in CSE, so it's like, you know, the sexual exploitation and trafficking of teenage girls and younger, and much younger actually, but also of adult women, that we are deliberately, actually, we are deliberately positioning women and girls as mentally ill. And that this happens at lots of different stages, that it can happen at disclosure. So a woman or girl actually, you know, tells the police, tells the GP, tells the mental health worker, tells the support worker, whatever. And then they're referred through to some form of mental health assessment, some sort of psychological assessment, which then positions them as mentally ill. And we don't use words like that anymore, because the same thing happened in mental health as it did in CSE. You get this palatable, hygienic language that takes over the sector. So everybody starts talking in acronyms and in language that is disconnected from what they're actually talking about. So, for example, we don't say mental illness anymore because people say that's offensive. But, you know, you would have to be naive to think that they're not actually considering these women to be mentally ill. For example, we don't say disordered anymore. Oh, they have mental disorders. We don't say that because it's seen as offensive. But every single diagnosis that women and girls are given are classed scientifically as a mental disorder or abnormality, which is, you know, what is in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, which is where all the psychiatric disorders and mental health issues come from. So, you know, we can be under no illusion here, because women and girls who are being subjected to these forms of violence all over the world are then disclosing and being told they have borderline personality disorder, that they have bipolar, depression, anxiety, postpartum psychosis, and things like that. And then with those labels, services are able to ignore them. They're able to blame them. They're able to medicate them. They're able to, you know, stop services altogether for them. They're able to position them as too chaotic and too complex for anybody to help them. To say, you know, oh, we don't support them because their mental health needs are too high and all that sort of stuff. So one of the things that I've been working on a lot recently, which is what the new book's on, is this positioning of women as sexy but psycho, which is, that's why that's the title of the book, that women are sex objects, they're there to have sex with men, and you know, that's what we're for. But ultimately, if we speak out, or if we are assertive, or if we say something that people don't like, or we are gender non-conforming, or we are gay, then we are mentally ill in some way. And you know, psychiatry and the mental health movement has a very, very long history of positioning women who have been trafficked, exploited, abused, harmed, raped by men as being mentally disordered, as being dangerous, and it would be very common for them to be locked up or put in asylums or tortured or put in prison and things like that. So it's something that I think that we should be paying a lot more attention to. This victim blaming of women in prostitution, women who've been exploited and trafficked, who are still being exploited and trafficked, many of them have several psychiatric diagnoses at once without anybody considering how traumatized they actually are. Women and girls living through these forms of exploitation are immensely traumatized, and there is nothing wrong with that. The trauma is completely natural, it's normal, it's valid, it's rational, it's justified. It will be with them for the rest of their lives, and we can work with that. You know, for me as a trauma-informed psychologist, I do not expect those women to get to a point in their life where they're totally fine about it, they don't have flashbacks anymore, the nightmares are all gone, that, you know, that everything is fine and that it's as if it never happened. That's not the way trauma works. It's not the way trauma memories work. But I do think that if we were to approach our feminism and our services and our understandings and interventions from a trauma-informed angle, we would no longer pathologize and medicate these women and girls who have been subjected to, you know, hundreds, thousands of rapes and sexual assaults and things like that. I'm happy to take questions on that afterwards if that's anything, you know, that you would want to discuss. So I guess in conclusion, what you're looking at really with women who have been exploited and trafficked or have been in prostitution is the real classic victim blaming, which is a mixture between behavioral and characterological victim blaming. And behavioral blame is what tends to happen first. So, you know, when a woman discloses, or you find out that a woman is, you know, for example, let's take the example that we find out that a woman is being exploited, or she says she's a sex worker, or we find out she's in prostitution, however, you know, she terms that, or however some other professional terms that. One of the first things that will happen is that her behavior will be attacked, and that's called behavioral victim blaming. So we look for what she did wrong, something she could change in her behavior. Lots of services, including policing, social care, mental health teams, private therapists, they'll look for behavioral change. Whereas I would argue that it's not her that needs to change at all. It's the, you know, the situation, the environment, the fact that she's being oppressed and harmed. So in terms of, you know, the behavioral, the attack on her behavior, that tends to be like one part of it. The next part is always attack on character. Women are then attacked characterologically. So characterological blame is the attack on her. Like, she's naive, she's stupid, she's promiscuous, you know, she trusts people too easily, she, you know, she's too streetwise, she's whatever, like that kind of like real sort of attack on your character as a woman and girl. And you know, that happens in lots of forms of violence and abuse. So that's really what we're seeing here with the pathologization, is that not only do you get this behavioral blame and characterological blame, but they then start to attack your mental well-being. That they suggest that the reason that you are behaving in these ways, the reason that you are, I don't know, for example, drinking, or you've self-harmed, or you want to die, or something like that, is nothing to do with all of these crimes you've been subjected to. It's actually in your head. It's a daughter, it's something wrong with you. And I consider that to be the ultimate form of victim blaming of women and girls who have been subjected to these crimes. So I'm going to stop there, if that's okay. I think I saw a question pop up in my chat. Gemma, is that okay if I take it, or is that for everybody? Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can take it.
Yeah, okay. So the question that's popped up is, speaking about grooming of female students into prostitution, do you think that maybe such products such as Secret Diary of a Call Girl, the book and the TV show, were commissioned by some sort of pimp lobby? I'm not 100% sure who commissioned it, but I would suggest that the reason that it thrived and the reason that it was seen as so sexy and powerful was because we already live in a society that pretty much commissions that type, you know, that type of exploitation and abuse of women and girls anyway. So obviously a film like that would do well, a book like that would do well, because, you know, women and girls are being groomed into this from an early age. Sexualization, objectification, for example, we know that the most recent research shows that girls from the around the age of 7 start to see themselves through the male gaze. And that's not something that we used to see. Self-objectification and self-sexualization in women and girls in a patriarchy tends to happen around 13, 14 years old. But the most recent research, and it's not even that recent anymore, it was like 2007, 2010, found that that age dropped to 7. So little girls around 7 now start to self-sexualize and see themselves as sex objects for men and boys. So if you consider, you know, how groomed women and girls actually are by the time that they're in university and they're sort of, you know, 18, 19, 20, it's not really going to be that difficult to sort of groom and then position this as a brilliant idea that's sexy and empowering. And I know I definitely thought that when I was younger. Like I remember sitting in English with my best friends, and we thought, now I'm 30, so I'm born 1990, so I would have been sat in English, what, 2004 2005, thinking this is going to be great, and we're going to be sex workers, and we're going to be strippers. And there was a bar where we lived, and we were like, we're going to just earn loads of money, and we're going to sleep with rich men. It's going to be amazing. And then we're going to pay our way through university, so we've got no debt. And I remember those conversations, and I remember thinking that that was like, we genuinely hadn't received any counter narratives to that at that age. So, you know, I can totally see how young women are being groomed into this. I genuinely can. Okay, I'll pass it back to Ali if you like, and then I'll go with however you want to structure the rest of the session. But thank you for listening.
Hi, thanks, Jessica. You know, I could pick on so much that you just mentioned. It would have been very difficult. But a couple of things that I picked up on, just because of my own working background as well, was about the history of the language, especially around, you know, with regards to prostitution and young girls. You know, that for me, I remember only 2 years ago, I'm a social worker, and I had to pick up in a safeguarding conference that they were still using the term, you know, child prostitute, and this was 2 years ago. Yeah. So it's not that far gone. So that was interesting you said that. And another big one for me was about the erasing of perpetrators and how they aren't even like looked at in that arena. So hopefully, you know, we can get something sort of started around that, like we have now, at least with domestic abuse, for example.
Yeah, I think, I don't know whether I mentioned it, but you know, the term child prostitution was only actually removed from the Sexual Offences Act in 2016. And it was only removed from government legislation in the same year. So if you consider that that was only 4 or 5 years ago that it was effectively removed, that's not that long ago.
No. Mm. I mean, it's awful. And a big one for me as well, working mainly with the domestic abuse field, was the way that you were talking about positioning women as mentally ill. And, you know, I think the fact that, you know, some of us are starting to see, you know, the sort of the trauma, sort of the effects of trauma, and how that is a natural response to what they've gone through. But, you know, I've had women just come into my my groups and, you know, my one-to-one sessions and saying, my doctor just told me I'm going to be on medication for life because I'm mentally unwell. And what is that saying to women, you know? So, again, I think that's a fantastic thing that you've just sort of brought up for a lot of, you know, a lot of people in this webinar to go away and think about how they work with women.
I think that's a really difficult topic. And that's why I've written the new book on it, that I want people to be able to see the evidence base around this, that, you know, you are 7 times more likely as a woman to be diagnosed with these psychiatric disorders, and you are much more likely, 20, 30 times more likely, if you disclose abuse. Yeah. Like we've got to start considering the fact that women are being told to come forward and tell the truth and say, you know, tell us you're being abused, we'll help you. And then they're telling us and we're going, right, mental health team. And then they're being given a psychiatric diagnosis, or they're being told, like you say, by the doctors, You've got treatment resistant this, treatment resistant that, you're going to be on medication for the rest of your life, and that, you know, all we can hope to do really is manage the symptoms. Like, I don't want to work in a field like that. Why are all these women being told they're mentally ill? So
so just terrifying. To sort of bringing that up, I think, is really, you know, really important. So as you said, we go on to have a discussion now with you and Lily as well, and I've got some questions here. So the first one, and some of these you've already brought up, Jessica, is how does pathologizing of trauma impact prostitution and trafficking survivors, and how does it serve as another form of victim blaming?
Well, I've already spoken. So, Lily, did you want to answer it from your perspective?
Yeah, so I will start off with my personal perspective. Now, frankly, I'm very lucky and I was savvy enough as a teenager to stay the hell out of this system. So I started off, I ended up being stuck in the system quite early on, but it was before I disclosed too much about what was happening. I've been being offered therapy from the NHS, and by therapy, I mean 6 weeks of CBT, from the age of about 13, 14. Mm. And I got so many different diagnoses within that short space of time before I even disclosed exactly what my history was. And when I say history, I mean my current lived experience was. And one thing I count myself as being lucky on is my age. Now, the time that I was engaging with NHS mental health services, I was too young. Borderline hadn't come into fashion yet. And I know that my treatment would have been so incredibly different if borderline was kind of in vogue at that point. Mm. I was at a point where bipolar was still the in thing, and I did end up with that diagnosis, which doesn't fit who I am at all. I'm too lazy to be manic. But the whole kind of system was something that made it significantly worse for me. The very much like you've been talking about, and I know that your work is about quite often, is that sense of there was something wrong with me, that I had this diagnosable condition. I had something that could be fixed with medication, which is absolutely ridiculous because no amount of medication was going to make it so I was no longer being trafficked. It wasn't going to change that situation. And if anything, a lot of the medication that I was on at that age left me feeling more depressed, more numb, less able to process what was happening to me. And it made me more vulnerable. It made it easier for me to be exploited and trafficked in that way. As I got older, I started to, I don't know, instinctively recognize a lot of the similarities that exist between mental health systems and traffickers, that actually there was some really similar behaviors and techniques and manipulation that was happening. And I kind of opted out of that system. When I left when I was 22, I went on to disability benefits because I just reached a point where I couldn't function. And that's the one time that I will ever say that a mental health diagnosis is handy and engaging with that medical model is handy, because you can't claim benefits if you don't engage with that model, because then there's nothing wrong with you if you haven't medically got something wrong with you. But I wasn't on a lot of money because I was on disability benefits, but I also had an eating disorder, which meant that I wasn't spending a lot of money anyway. And it meant I could access private therapy. And because of all of my multiple courses of CBT and a little bit of psychoanalysis, I knew I needed and wanted something different. And it meant I was able to access person-centered therapy. And with a therapist that doesn't use the medical model, the closest she ever gets is looking at fight, flight and freeze. And I don't entirely agree with that theory, but it's definitely better than anything else that's on offer. And it gave me that opportunity to be out of that system. But before that point, I was thrown on every single medication going, and all of them I had a really bad reaction to. I mean, full-blown hallucinations where I felt like there was little men crawling under my skin, where I got sectioned after being changed onto a new medication because it had such an impact on me. And it just, it took a really long time to get out of that system. And I'm really lucky that I was able to do it in a way where I wasn't described as being avoidant or kind of chased down for it or sectioned for it. I just kind of quietly slipped away. I think changing my name and moving quite a distance away helped with that as well. But there's something about the pathologizing, though, that it is the fact that it's deemed complex, I think, is the big thing for me. And that quite often that phrase is one that's used to turn people away from services. whether that's NHS services, where if you've been diagnosed borderline, they won't offer you therapy and a lot of trust, because you're too crazy and therapy isn't indicated within the NICE guidelines for you. So therefore you're not having any support. But also within charity services as well, that if you're too complex, then you can't be helped. You're going to be stuck like this forever. And there is absolutely nothing that can ever change. Mm. And that's not what I believe, either personally or professionally. I know personally, because I am nowhere near the same really messed up person that I was a couple of years ago. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't entirely go away. I've had a terrible week and I felt anxiety in a way that I haven't for years this week, or anxious feelings in a way I haven't for years this week. Mm. It's still always there, but there's something about those labels that mean that people can't access services and then get given more labels that denies even more services. And it locates that problem within that individual, and it doesn't recognize that patriarchal society that sanctions that abuse, and it doesn't recognize the perpetrators in that as well. And I know I'm now repeating some of what you said, so I'm going to pass it back to either yourself, Jessica, if you've got more, or Ali for another question here.
No, I just completely agree with what you're saying, that I think that's the most important point, really, is that what happens with the pathologization of women and girls who've been subjected to this is, as you say, is that all that trauma, all those crimes, all that, you know, oppression, all of that discrimination, all of the things that they've been subjected to gets located in their head. And that, for me, when I was still working, you know, in frontline practice, that for me was a massive wake-up call, was that, you know, I was working at the time with a few hundred women and girls on our waiting list, and I ran a rape center, and you know, all of my counselors, I have 30 counselors, and when I was doing supervisions with them, it was like, oh, she's got BPD, oh, she's got bipolar, oh, she's got psychosis, oh, she's got these diagnoses, oh, she's this, she's that. And I mean, I was probably what, 23 24, something like that, and I remember just thinking, how have they all got these diagnoses? Like, this makes no sense. And this was before I knew anything. This is before I'd looked critically at the medical model and looked critically at the pathologization of women and girls, because you very much accept these things passively, that, oh, you know, she's got anxiety disorder, and like, oh, she's got bipolar, she's got borderline personality disorder. And then we've also had this added narrative recently, which is like, don't pill shame, don't shame people for having mental health issues, which is not the point. The point is that they're not mentally ill at all. It's not that we're shaming them. It's that somebody, I don't know how a professional can either listen to a woman or a girl talk about the things that they've been through and then locate that in her head as a disorder. I just don't know how you can ethically do that. But even if you didn't know exactly what happened to a woman or girl, surely you can tell there's something not right. You can tell they're stressed, you can tell they're tired, you can tell that they're not eating and sleeping properly, you can tell that they're scared, you can tell they're angry, you can tell they're sad, you can tell they're panicking, you can tell that they're overwhelmed. Wouldn't the most obvious thing to do is sort of assume that there's something happening, that there's something wrong, rather than being like, you know what that is, it's your brain chemistry. I don't know how we got to that position. I think it's appalling.
Thank you. Okay, so the next question then is something that comes up across a number of our webinars, but this one is around the sex work narrative. So how do sex workers' work narratives impact prostituted and trafficked women? And does this act as another form of victim blaming? I don't know who wants to answer that one.
Do you want to go before me, Lily?
Yeah, that sounds good to me. So I think there's two things. So I think part of it is about services, and that kind of sex work narrative means that people within those services, and yes, I acknowledge not all of them, but there's an assumption made that not all of those experiences are rape or sexual violence within themselves, that the work as a whole was not necessarily traumatic in and of itself, but there might have been a one-off rape within that, and you can talk about that one-off rape, but the whole thing is kind of treated as being okay otherwise. And I think the other side of it is the phrase I've got in my head is cognitive dissonance, but I don't actually like that, but this kind of happy hooker narrative that those within the sex industry are there out of choice and it's empowering. And those women might choose to believe those messages. I know I did at one point, because they're easier to accept than the reality. Because I had two options. So when I was about 19, it was something that I used to kind of almost like showing off. I was the most sexually experienced out of all of my friends. I'd slept with more than any of them. And I was this really empowered, wonderful, sexualized woman. And it's because the reality was acknowledging that my mum had been raping me since I was a day old, that I'd been being trafficked from the age of four, that I had been raped more times than I could count, and that there was a pain and a trauma with that that had messed me up in a way that I couldn't cope with. And those messages end up portraying that abuse and that violence and those rapes as being something that's a choice. And it was easier. It was so much easier to accept that as my reality instead of what actually was the reality. It was the only way that I could bring myself to get through it. And I think that's really, really dangerous, because ultimately the thing that got me in this position where I'm at now, where I can do this webinar, where I can do the work that I do, was actually recognizing it as violence against women and girls, as recognizing it as male violence, of recognizing the pain and the trauma and the horror that I experienced, the torture that I experienced as that. And I think the more that we repeat those sex work is work narratives, the more we're colluding with those messages, and the more that women that are in those experiences, it's not going to validate the reality. It's not going to allow women to go, actually, I need to get out. I need something to be different. That it's painful.
I just agree with everything you said. I think in terms of sex work is work being victim blaming, I think it's, again, I worry whenever there's a mantra, to be honest with you. If there's a mantra involved, there's usually something bad going on. So the fact that we're all encouraged and people say it over and over again, and it's become this, I don't know, this phrase, this almost like a slogan, always worries me. Because it's, you know, to me that sounds like brainwashing, grooming type thing. You know, if you get people to say something over and over again until they believe it, then eventually they'll stop questioning it. But one of the things that struck me when it happened, because I've always been concerned around that narrative, was if you successfully position prostitution as work, as sex work, and then you get these people arguing that it's the same as working at McDonald's, it's the same as being a cleaner, it's the same as, you know, being a, I don't know, a person working in a call center. What you then get next is the legitimization of men raping, abusing, torturing, beating women and girls. And that's a job. It's part of the job. It's part of the risks of the job that, you know. So how can women come forward at that point? How can they complain? How can they report it? How can they get any justice? How can they be protected? Because it's just par for the course. It's just what happens when you work in that job. And that worries me. And then the second thing about that worries me around victim blaming is the whole, well, if you're in poverty, if you're struggling, why don't you just, you know, go get an OnlyFans, or, you know, go into prostitution? And, you know, if society successfully positions prostitution as literally a form of work, then obviously the next thing that will happen is it'll literally be a job. It'll be a job that you can advertise. And, you know, the Job Centre already had that. We already had the Department for Work and Pensions advertising, you know, sex work as an actual job. And if you didn't apply for it, you could have your benefits sanctioned. That scares me to death. Like, that to me would be a form of victim blaming that I would worry about immensely, is the whole, like, if you're in poverty, you know, as a woman, and you're refusing to go into sex work and to apply for these jobs, and it's your own fault you're in poverty and nobody's going to help you and we're going to take everything off you. That's, you know, there's just so many elements of it that if you position men's illegal access and the buying of consent as a form of work, how do you protect any of these women ever? That just worries me.
So in terms of that, then, what you've just said, how do victim blaming messages impact the ability for women to recover from their experiences in prostitution?
Lily, do you mind if I answer this, or did you want to go before me?
No, you go ahead.
If I speak purely from the evidence and the research, we know that when women and girls are blamed, they will essentially be more traumatized. So we know that the violence they're subjected to is enough, you know, to cause considerable trauma. But we also know that, for example, around 87% of women and girls who tell their family they've been subjected to these crimes are likely to be blamed by their family. So family victim blaming is very, very common. It's actually the most common response. If you ever disclose to your family as a woman or girl that you've been raped, assaulted, harassed, stalked, whatever it is, you are very, very likely to have your family turn against you and blame you. And so you've got the family and your support network element of that. Then you've got services and professionals element. And we know that victim blaming is extremely common in mental health services, social care, policing, and in wider sectors, housing, just, you know, drug and alcohol services, counselling services. Victim blaming is still extremely common. And that's because the research suggests that victim blaming attitudes are held at the same rate in professionals as they are in the general public. So some people, I guess, believe that if you're working with a professional, they should victim blame you less because they're a professional and they're educated. But that isn't the case. There are no attitudinal differences between victim in a therapist or some guy you just met on the street. There's also no difference between men and women. Victim blaming between men and women is statistically the same and has been for over a decade. And that's because men have always victim blamed at a very high level of women and girls being subjected to this stuff. And then over a period of time, it was women's victim blaming that came up to meet men at that level. Men's victim blaming has never dropped, but women's has gone up. So we are now at the point where you're just as likely to be blamed by if you told a man as if you told a woman. There is obviously then the issue of self-blame, self-doubt. We know that victim blaming narratives stop women and girls from coming forward altogether. We know that the disclosure rates of these crimes drop every single year and have been dropping for over a decade. They're at the lowest they've ever been in terms of disclosure and reporting to police. You know, victim blaming narratives impact juries. They impact entire systems. They change interventions. They shape the way that whole services respond to these women and girls. So it means that in terms of their own trauma and the impact on them, they'll question themselves over and over. Was it my fault? Could I have done something differently? Should I have left earlier? Should I have done something different? Was it something about me? Was it my character? Was it my behavior? Am I stupid? Am I naive? Why didn't I see this coming? I should have seen the signs. That really, really does impact women and girls for a long, long time. It takes a lot to work through and deconstruct victim blaming and self-blame messages.
Yeah, I would really agree with that. And that those internalized messages were the thing that kind of knocked me more than anything. I have really clear memories. So when I was 22, I moved to a new flat, and that flat became a place of hell for me, where I was kind of stuck between all of these things. I was stuck between those victim blaming messages. I was stuck between the way I'd internalized them and was using them against myself. I was stuck between all the messages I'd had growing up about who I was, what I was worth, what I was destined for. And there were points where I couldn't cope with all of those messages going round over and over again. And I would end up curled up on the floor just screaming. And because I couldn't deal with them. And there was this constant sense of not being worth any kind of help or support, not being worth a life different than the life I'd already lived. And it was because of those questions. It was because of that sense of, well, why did I let it happen for so long? Why was I stuck in that situation for 22 years? And I could maybe forgive 4-year-old me. But once I reached the age of about 14, that's when I started really questioning the experiences that I had. Because I was at an age where I knew what sex was. I knew what sex wasn't supposed to be. I knew what was happening for me. I started having the words and the language to understand what was happening. And it still carried on. And then I ended up in an abusive relationship. And then I ended up in another abusive relationship, and I was groomed online, and I was still being trafficked, and I was reaching the point where I was 22 years old. I was a professional working in a youth work field, supporting young women that were being abused themselves. And I was still in that situation. And that became something that I would beat myself up with on a regular basis, because why did I let it happen for so long? And then there were specific memories in that. So even after I was able to end that last abusive relationship, he would come banging on my door, knocking on my door. My mum would do the same, because I'd stopped being someone else's possession, which meant she could come and reclaim me as her possession, and her boyfriend could come and reclaim me as their possession. And every time they banged on that door, because I was so broken, and because I blamed myself so much, and because I didn't believe myself to be worth anything, I would always eventually end up unlocking that door. And that is something that even now, when I know so much better and I'm a professional in this field and I hear this victim blaming, this internal narrative from so many people, it's still something where it catches, where I hear it or I think about it and I start questioning all of my own experiences. I start going back to those messages that they've told me year after year about how it was something that I wanted, something that I deserved, something that I was worth, something I was destined to be, that I never deserved a different life. And it always feels like everything I have right now is going to crumble and I'm going to end up back there because that's all I'm worth. And those messages, those experiences really reinforce that. And no matter how hard I try, no matter how much I know better, completely shifting those internalized narratives, those internalized victim blaming, self-blame narratives, it's really hard, really, really hard.
So how do you think we can work with the women who have internalized these victim blaming messages?
That's something that I've been interested in for a while, because when I've interviewed professionals about how they're attempting to do this, they'll often say that they don't really know how to do that or whether it works. And I would probably support that in that one of the things that we know doesn't work is simply telling women, oh, you're not to blame, right? And I know that might sound sort of odd to say that, but if you're working with a woman who has been subjected to all these things and then she's sat in front of you saying, it's my fault, I should have known better, I should have done this, why didn't I do that? My research and other people's research found that if you just sort of go, well, you know, it's not your fault, you're not to blame, and, you know, you're wrong, you know. The danger there is that you've not really done any work around that trauma. You've not really done anything to help her deconstruct the victim blaming or the self-blame, or considered what purpose the self-blame serves for her. All you've done is told her she's wrong, so all you've done is disempowered her further. You've not really achieved anything by doing that. So that's one of the issues. And the problem with that is that we actually probably should look at self-blame as a coping mechanism as well, which would probably help from a trauma-informed perspective. That self-blame for women and girls tends to make them feel more in control. So there's theories from cognitive psychology called counterfactual thinking, and what that and the locus of perceived control. And what that means is that when women and girls believe that it was something they could have done differently, and then they attempt to make some form of change. So say, for example, they were raped, I don't know, let's use a very stereotypical example, they were raped while they were drunk. So now they've decided they're never drinking again, and they're not going to go out drinking with their friends because they were irresponsible last time and they were raped while they were drunk, and that's why it happened. So now they're going to limit their alcohol intake. What we know from the research is that women and girls who go down that type of counterfactual thinking will believe that they're back in control. So you tend to see in them a feeling of power, control. I'm in control now. I don't drink. This won't happen to me again, because now I know what caused it, my behavior caused it, so I can change my behavior and then it'll be okay. So if you bulldoze into that and say, well, actually, it wasn't the drink, it was the perpetrator, which is true, absolutely true. That's what we want them to get to eventually, is that nothing they could have done differently would have protected them because the perpetrator had targeted them and chosen to commit that offense. That's exactly where we want them to get, but you can't get them there simply by dismissing them, by saying, well, actually, you're wrong. If you take that coping mechanism away, so that they no longer blame themselves, so the counterfactual thinking isn't there, so they no longer feel that they have any power, you tend to get a massive crash in terms of their well-being, that they become traumatized and re-traumatized because they suddenly then have to face the fact they have no control, and that they could stop drinking, but then what if their next partner rapes them? What caused it then? What are they going to change then? And then they have to do the processing and the work that none of it was ever their fault. They couldn't have done anything different. The perpetrator was totally in control. And yes, it could happen again. It could happen again. And it wouldn't be their fault. That's a really scary prospect for women and girls that are using self-blame as a coping mechanism and a way to feel like they know what happened and how they're going to control it in the future. So I guess, you know, there's quite a lot to be said here. But Lily, did you want to answer too?
Yeah, so I actually use a similar theory than you, apart from I jump over to existential therapy to describe the same thing. So existential therapy talks about the fact that a lot of the difficulties that we face in life fall within various existential dilemmas. And one of those is about power and control. And yeah, exactly what you said. For me, it was about unpicking those victim blaming messages in my own therapy with my therapist. And what my therapist offered me was consistency. So she never colluded with my own victim blaming messages, but she also outright didn't come at them with a sledgehammer. She took it very gently and very slowly. She made it clear both in her words and her actions that she didn't agree with me, but she didn't destroy them either. And it slowly gave me back. It actually gave me that sense of power and control, not the false sense of power and control that I had. Because it helped me to realize that actually the world is a very unsafe place, and that men in particular are very unsafe, that it's like playing a game of Russian roulette. You don't know which ones are safe. You don't know which ones aren't. And whilst it sounds really counterintuitive, once I was able to accept that the world wasn't safe, that I can't control it, that it could potentially happen to me again at any point. Once I reached that point, I actually felt better, and it gave me more of a sense of power and control, and it gave me the ability to trust my own gut judgment. It gave me the ability to not just outright think every single man is a risk to me, but to actually start paying attention to those skills that my 22 years of being tortured and raped had actually given me, that I could spot a perpetrator a mile off, and I could trust my own judgment and those red flags that I was seeing in a way that I couldn't before. And it gave me the ability to keep myself safer and to give me more of a sense of power whilst also accepting the reality that I have sod all power at all. And it's similar to what I do in my work now. And I think sometimes it's about planting that tiny little seed of doubt almost. And it sounds manipulative, and that's not the way I do it. It sounds manipulative as I'm saying it now. But it's about very gently challenging those victim blaming narratives. And I say to clients things like, what could you have done differently? Because they tell me they could have done something differently. So I very gently ask them, what was that? And the more that they sort of explore that, the more they realize that actually it wouldn't have mattered. So a lot of clients tell me, oh, well, I could have fought back. And I ask them, what would have happened if you'd fought back? And they know the answer to that, because there is a damn well a reason why they didn't fight back in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's a very gentle and delicate process, because you're right. When those victim blaming messages are so strong and so internalized, that actually leaves people in quite a fragile place. And because it is a coping mechanism, like you've said, and if you go in it with it like a sledgehammer, things are just going to go downhill really, really quickly. So it has to be done so gently. And it can be infuriating. It can be infuriating session after session, going very gently through the same idea. But it's about really recognizing what that process is for that client, what the process is for that person, why they're in that place, why it's so important to them, and staying with them during that process and showing compassion for that person who has had to blame themselves to be able to reach the place that they're in now, where they are safe.
Yeah. And it's like not making it about you as the professional or as the service, that, like you just said, so many professionals get frustrated or like, sort of, why can't she get this? You know, we've told her it's not her fault and she still blames herself after all these years. You're like, this isn't your journey. This isn't about you. Do you know what I mean? It's not about us. You've got to be there and you've got to allow them to go through whatever it is they need to process. And you're just there to hold them and structure that a little bit and bounce it back, like you said, reflect it a little bit, you know, it does worry me when professionals sort of get to the point where they're like annoyed that they can't get a message through to a woman that's processing loads of trauma, as if it's just that simple.
Yeah, my theory is that if the work is stuck, if something isn't working in the way that you're expecting, 9 times out of 10, it's the therapist, not the client. And it's because you've got your own agenda, your own motivation, you're trying to push something and that client isn't ready to go there with you yet. And the most important thing you can do is back off, go back to those core conditions, which is a phrase from person-centered therapy. It's about being honest and open with your client. It's about showing them empathy and like really understanding their perspective and showing them absolute basic compassion. And when you go back to that and stay with them through their process with very, very gentle, tiny little baby steps of challenges, that's when you're more likely to get them to the place that you want them to be at, because you really want them to see that it's not their fault. You really want them to be able to go out and live in the world and feel okay. And of course we do. Like, any therapist that denies that is completely missing, or any worker that works in any field with people, there is a selfish motivation. We want people to be okay. But if you push that agenda too much, it's never actually going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, thank you both. I mean, I think hopefully, I mean, there's a lot of us on this webinar tonight that work, you know, on the ground with people, with women specifically. And I think, you know, what you've just discussed, especially for me, has just been a massive help, you know. So that's been really great. Thank you. So there's a question we've had from a previous webinar, which I think is very relevant to tonight's discussion as well. What would be the best way to approach a woman who is currently still in prostitution and believes she entered it freely and it's her choice? How do you begin a conversation about the exploitative nature of this industry without invalidating her point of view and personal experience?
I've had a lot of these conversations recently. So I've just been working with an organization that works with women in prostitution and sex work, and we've had this conversation going on now for weeks about how best do you do that from a feminist, trauma-informed, anti-victim blaming approach. You don't want to pathologize them, you don't want to sort of almost like preach to them and tell them like you're wrong, you know, this is exploitation. Like, of course we want to protect them and keep them safe, but that won't work if you go in there sort of, you know, you know you're in the wrong, why are you doing this, don't you know how dangerous it is, and men are all perps, that sort of thing. Like yes, we know those things are correct, but like how do you do that in the moment? And we came to the conclusion recently that one of the best things you can do is meet them where they're at. Like, if they're going to approach a service and they initially just approach you because, I don't know, they've lost somewhere to live, or they're struggling with their benefits, or they need, I don't know, help with the fact that their child is being removed from them, they're having a social care assessment, is to meet them where they're at. So eventually, if you naturally build rapport with somebody, she is going to tell you the stuff that's going on. She's going to tell you that she's injured, or she's going to turn up, you know, injured, or something's going to happen that she's going to need to be able to talk to somebody about. So if your organizations or you as a professional can just be with them and be there and listen and make sure that they know that you're not judging her, that you're not, you know, you don't have an issue with her, that you care about her, and that you're going to be there if she needs to talk to you about this stuff that's going on, whatever it is, and that you're not necessarily going to push her if she's not ready, and that you don't have any interest in telling her what to do, but that you as an organization or as a service can provide lots of different approaches to this, that if you want to exit, I'm going to be here and I'm going to help you get out of this. If you can't do that yet and there are other things I can help you with, like housing or money or health or something that's going on with your kids or whatever, then I'm going to help you with that. If you want access to trauma therapy, you want to talk about some of the shit that's happening, I can talk to you about that. But like that, I guess that's what we came to in the end, was that, you know, some women, they're not ready yet, they might not be ready for a long time. There's loads of reasons why that might be, everything from practical financial reasons all the way through to psychological reasons. There's so many reasons why, and we don't want to ever make a woman feel judged, alienated, or further oppressed or discriminated by professionals or our services at all.
Yeah, I don't have much. Sorry, Ali.
No, I was going to say, Lily, would you like to respond?
I don't feel like I have much to add. I think, I think we were touching on that at the end of the last question as well, the idea that it's just about compassion and, yes, staying with where they are in that process and checking your own agenda, that we're not here, no matter what field it is we're working in. If we're working with women that are being prostituted, that are being trafficked, it is, unless it's actually your job to help them exit or to teach them about feminist Nordic model approaches to trafficking and prostitution, then it's about staying with that person and their process and checking what your agenda is and checking whether you're trying to force that on that person. Because this type of abuse, this rape, this torture, it's all a violation. It's a violation of their boundaries. It's a violation of their power. It's a violation of their bodily integrity. It's a violation of their very life and their way to choose to live their life as they want to. And we don't want to be adding to that. We don't want to be yet another person in their life, telling them what to do, telling them how to live their life, telling them that they're wrong, telling them that they're worth something different than what they believe. And even if it comes from a good place with really good intentions, where we really want to make such a positive difference in their lives, it doesn't matter. What matters is where that woman is at that moment in time and working with that.
That's great. Thank you. So we're practically out of time now. So I want to thank Lily and Dr. Jessica Taylor for giving their time and sharing their knowledge and expertise so brilliantly tonight. So thank you very much both. So I'm going to just share my screen for a minute and put up some links that hopefully you'd find useful. So here's Nordic Model Now's information. So we've got obviously nordicmodelnow.org's website, where there's lots of information and resources that you can go on to and have a look. Our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram is at Nordic Model Now. And our email address is nordicmodelnow@gmail.com. And here's Jessica's information. So that's www.drjessicataylor.com, at Dr. Jess Taylor, and www.victimfocus.org.uk. And finally, please can you sign and share our petition about the sex work toolkit that Leicester University is publishing and trying to share across the UK in universities. So please go onto our website if you want that link as well, and it's there, and also on our Facebook page. So once again, I'd like to thank everybody for coming this evening, and have a good rest of the night, and please just go onto our website and like our stuff and share it as much as possible. So thank you. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to the Nordic Model Now podcast. Nordic Model Now is a UK grassroots women's group campaigning for the abolition of prostitution and related practices such as lap dancing, pornography and surrogacy. Find us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Nordic Model Now, or visit our website at nordicmodelnow.org. Thank you.